And that's what he says. And when he comes to town, I want you to shake hands with him. So when Hamilton Hope came to town, my father and I, in the first adult companionship I'd ever enjoyed, went down. Now the moral of that story is, how ridiculous it is, that 60 years ago, the only two people in America that cared about world government were Hamilton Holt and a 12-year-old boy, to exaggerate a little, but not very much. Now we've had the League of Nations and the United Nations. Can't we see that as a part of the metamorphosis of mankind, world government is here to stay? This one may fail, but world government, if man survives, is in a day of such rapid transportation, communication, and so on, here to stay. Now, you may differ with me on the next one, but please don't hate me for it. I just have to say the way the thing seems to me. In 1932, the only subdivisions of land was political, states or nations. You've got some nations as large as the Soviet Union and some tiny little ones like Switzerland or smaller and so on. You've got states as large as Texas and others as small as Rhode Island, Delaware. Then in 1933, after 11 years of effort, George Norris persuaded Franklin Roosevelt, very autocratically, I must admit, to set up the Tennessee Valley Authority. That was a part of economic area number one in the United States. In Alabama, there were 39 times as many murders in proportion to the population as in Wisconsin. You know, whether you approve or not, this story. They put in calcium dams like the vertebrae of the spinal cord from Paducah, backing up water 184 miles to Pickwick Diamond, Pickwick to Wheeling, Wheeling to Wilson to Wheeling, Wheeling to Guntersville, Halesville, Wattsville, Chickamauga, and so on. They got control of that river as far as flooding was concerned, so that when it would have emptied into the Ohio, just about where the Ohio empties into the Mississippi, and the Mississippi would be, say, at 54 feet flood, the Tennessee would normally add about 2 feet. They could turn off and can turn off and do turn off that river just as we'd turn off a faucet. Then they began developing hydroelectric power, and people said they'll never have any use for all of it. Now you know, whether you approve or not, that they produce far, far more from steam than from hydroelectric power. Now they're putting in the largest atomic power generator in the world. I was down there the other day and they said they wished they had not started that, but that's a part of this sequence of obsolescence, that they now know how to make a breeder reactor so powerful that they will be able to take all meters out of people's homes and just make a line charge for each house, and you can use all of the electricity you want. I mentioned that to a banker who said in horror, what'll that do to the private enterprise? Well, I'm thinking at the moment of human beings, and I suppose, because we have to be concerned with everyone, that private enterprise will be able to do the same thing. There's no mystery about it. They have no monopoly on such knowledge as that. Then in health, that place had several hundred thousand cases of malaria every season. They've not had a single one. They let the water up and down, so when the lady mosquitoes laid their eggs, you know, and it turned into wigglers, they would drop it and dry them out, and then raise it and they'd lay more eggs and drop it and dry them out, and that way they fooled the mosquitoes to death. And there's been none now for a long time. So you get recreation. When I was a child, the only recreation there was hunting and sexual intercourse. And now they have more than 10,000 miles of shoreline and industry. 2,400 industries, Alcor, Reynolds, and so on, full employment. And they are really ready now to move. They've moved faster percentage-wise than the rest of the country. Well, I don't want to get in a position of having to defend, if I need to, with any of you, but I think that it is an idea that belongs to the future. And a test is the universality of the acceptance of these concepts that are new. And Russia has accepted it in the Dnipro and the Volga and Don complex. China is building many. India has, I believe, 24 TVAs, one of them engineered from Philadelphia and so on. So that I would say that the world is going to tend to be divided less into political states, more into natural tributary area development and certain other methods of subdivision, deserts and so on. Third, I think there has come within the last 40 or 50 years a self-awareness in community planning and community development. I started with students at Columbia, the Macedonia Cooperative Community in 1934, operated for 22 years as a cooperative and then became a religious community. It was regarded as a rather freakish thing. Now, Mexico has how many such communities that they call ejidos. I want all of our students to spend 2 or 3 months in a kibbutz in Israel, where there are many, many. In Russia and in China, they call them communes and run them in their way. In India, there are 2 or 3,000 such communities. Now, if you please, pause for a moment and reconstruct the world so that instead of having cities with slums and so on, within states, within nations, within the world, we gradually come through this process of metamorphosis to communities that are self-aware within regions that are organized, within a world that's organized. Now add to that another half dozen or dozen concepts. I'll not go further, you've been extremely patient, but I hope I've at least made clear that my motivation is that education be a search for a reasonable design for tomorrow so that man slough off all of the ails. Race prejudice has plagued mankind for millennia, and education has not gotten rid of it. Now there's a revolt against that, and education needs to lead the way in that revolt. We can absolutely obliterate poverty. We can improve health around the whole world. We can get control of population increase, and so through education. And I conclude by saying that I think one of these emerging concepts is world education itself. And I hope you all will come over to see the tiny little effort that we're making. We're in some military barracks where we're trying to beat spears into plowshares. So I'm out at the Livingston property. We inherited a Nike base. Down in Miami, we have an electronic vessel to use that was a mine layer. We seem to get only the crumbs from the military table. But more and more people are helping. And if I've seemed too dogmatic, I'm sorry. I would like to listen to you. I welcome you to come over to the school. We're not doing everything well. If it weren't for Sidney Harmon, who stepped in as a trustee and is perfectly marvelous, we wouldn't be doing as well as we are. Thank you.
Systems of my invitees to be here tonight. I rather isn't our spokesman a devil's advocate here? Our prototype of conservative education. I have some questions here. I rather reject the role because Oscar, you know, just speaking of those things by her own grasp, instead of innovating institutions in the country, you know, to study this or study the local civilization study, at least innovative education. And we have a few things going like New College, which do sound terribly conservative, he's speaking what you're talking about.
My brother taught him that for you, and he liked it very much indeed.
Well, too. Very efficiently. He's a smart fellow, the outset. But I think the kind of parents you outlined for the students in this country, Harlan, Marshall, some, and so on, is obviously a tremendous experience. Now, what do you do with, let's say, either the Russian student, I'm not picking on that because you have the Iron Curtain system, the culture in certain ways. What are you going to do with them to give them American experience when they're over here? What are you going to do with our American students when they're in like, or Scandinavia or whatnot? So can they get the same kind of depth of experience that an American student can get in Harlem or something?
I think the only thing that keeps them from it is their own hang-ups. Their own lack of readiness. They say, Morris, I'm not interested in these emerging concepts. I'm interested in people. Or they say, I'm not interested in great world ideas and remaking. I'm interested in what they like to call situational learning. That's the biggest problem I have. It satisfies them just to get out in Scandinavia and get to know the Scandinavians as people, or in Africa.
And they did this without the language?
Well, we enrolled under you in Scandinavian seminars, that is Adolf Anderson's program, and
they don't have a Russian seminar.
Those, well, because of Vietnam, we are able to do very little with the Soviet Union. They hold us off. I must tell you that we would go anywhere in the world. I'm quite obligated to go. So I wrote to the Peking government and asked if we could have a center there. And they said they liked the idea of a world college. They'd never heard of one, but it was a great idea. And when the level of hostility between the two countries subsided somewhat, to write them again. There's a lot with the individual. There's a Negro boy, John Rashford, and he knew English much better than I because he came from Jamaica and spoke kind of British English. Then he went down to Mexico and became fluent in Spanish. And then he went to Scandinavia. And they sent him over Scandinavia lecturing on world education in Swedish. And then he went to Vienna and they told me that he was able to visit in German homes and enjoy himself at considerable fluency. Now he's in Africa, and they tell me that he's quite good at Swahili. I don't know how much he remembers of these others, but he's terribly bright. But that's a very different story, frankly, from some that are sort of lost in themselves and haven't done. Well, some it takes a long time to wake up. But what I tried to say to them, not always successful, is you don't have to choose between knowing people and getting in situations and these ideas. For instance, if you go down to work with Al Foster, who's one of the greatest experts, I think, in the world in tree genetics and is finding all over some southern states the great elite trees that would transmit their characteristics and so on, and work with him, and he has a broad social vision. You get deeply into a situation and you get to know not only Al Foster but other people who are working in this connection. So I find that these people who are catching on are getting it three ways: situational, and personally and in terms, and that it will lead to employment in terms of something that they really very deeply care about. I ought to say I think there are limitations to anything that I know about. For instance, I wouldn't know how to train a scientist in this way. I'm not prepared to say one couldn't, but it's out of my... We just attempt to give sort of a cultural... I'd like for them to read books. There are more modern ones, but Reynolds had one on creative chemistry, and there was a Quaker that wrote a book, Stars and Atoms, for instance, things that way. We were given the other day $5,000 to fix up a greenhouse out there because it can be a good place to study marine biology, and we have saltwater marshes and freshwater marshes and uplands and lowlands, and six habitats, they say, and so we can. And then they have the use of this ship down in Miami. An astronomer is coming out. We've got two concrete towers that had radars on that are rooted 40 feet in the ground, solid concrete 7 feet through. He thinks he'll put an observatory up on top of one of them with a 10-inch telescope. He's bringing, well, I guess by running over the whole thing, you see that it's diffuse. I'd like Father to have enormous respect for science. I do it in my full ignorance of it. I'd like for them to know more of it than I do.
How successful have you been in recruiting students in other parts of the world?
Well, I think we ought to learn to do it with on our own students, but we're beginning now. The trouble is it costs $2,625, as cheap as we think we can do it. And in India, anybody that can find that much money isn't apt to want such an experimental program as this is. And those in Africa are apt to have had either French or British type of education that's very strict, you know, and Aristotelian, and it's very hard to win them over. To this, I think we'll first have to get accreditation and build a self-image.
How much reading is involved in the program? Talk to me about the action parts of the program. Is there any traditional study of quasi-traditional study of problems?
Well, I would say that although we have no lectures by design, very occasional indeed, and no assignments, and no textbooks, and no quizzes, and no examinations, and no grades, I would say that they do as much reading as those students would do under any circumstance. That is to say, some very, very little, and some a very great deal.
Is it pretty much on an independent basis, particular interests or events at a particular time?
Well, we are experimenting. The first term, we injected too many problems. We had a survey of all the problems, major problems, and we just had 2 or 3 days for each problem or area. We'd bring out Alan Krebs to talk about communism, and it's a religion to him. We'd bring Norman Thomas to try to sell them all on socialism. We'd bring out Walker Sandback on consumer cooperatives. And then we'd bring down from Middlebury in Vermont a perfectly magnificent and rich capitalist, extremely magnetic, and he was
Morris Joyce. In the middle of the 17th century, George Fox, the son of a Leicestershire Briton weaver, founded a society which is now called the Society of Friends, but whose members are better known as Quakers. Their distinctive character arises from a belief that a measure of God's Spirit is given to all men and women. Thus, the Society of Friends is a church order based on the priesthood of all believers, and its social outlook is based on the sacredness of every personality. The Quakers were among the first emigrants to the British colonies in the New World, and, as it happened in England before, soon they encountered trouble with the government in America as well. However, after many struggles, they became accepted, especially after the colonies achieved independence as the United States of America. By 1869, the Quakers had been accepted to the point where the President of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant, asked them to take charge of the various agencies established to care for the welfare of the American Indian. This was the beginning of a long interest in the welfare of the needy. It resulted in the restoration of devastated districts in northern France, Poland, and Serbia.